This is the Let's Get Real Estate Show with your host, Danielle Chason.
Full-time investor, strategic consultant, motivational coach, sought-after speaker,
and host of your number one real estate investing show, Let's Get Real Estate,
where real people are doing real estate.
Hey everyone, this is Michael Emmanuel, and I'm joining you with Danielle Chason on the Let's Get Real Estate podcast. In this episode, I talk about my backstory, how I transitioned from full-time employee to entrepreneur, best-selling author, and real estate investor. I talk about what I'm doing currently in my company, building additional dwelling units for investors. Make sure you check it out and enjoy the show.
Hey, everybody, it's Danielle Chason here, and we're back with the Let's Get Real Estate podcast. And this is where I bring to you real people doing real estate. And I'm very excited today to bring to you Michael Emmanuel to the show. Welcome to the show, Michael. Woo, woo.
Hey, Danielle. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no worries. It's great to have you on. So I'm excited to have you on because you and I have some history, some really solid history. And so we're going to get into the story that led you to me ultimately for a while where we were very involved with each other. And we'll share with the audience, we'll share with you, the audience, in a few minutes. However, before we get to that, I'm going to give you a brief introduction into Michael Emmanuel and so that you know who we are talking with. So Michael is actually an architect by design. He has an advanced diploma in architectural technology, a certificate in project management, which he did for a long time in corporate, and he's got over a decade in commercial and residential construction. And that's experience that he's taken now into his own businesses and what he does. And actually, and that's why he and I, when we crossed paths, ended up working together for a while. So Michael worked for me as a project manager back in 2022 for a while when he left corporate. But this guy is ambitious. He is driven and he has really, really taken off in building his own brand, his own businesses. And yes, businesses, because he has a designing business and he also has a construction business and construction management business. So there's all kinds of stuff going on in your world. You've written two books since you've left me and it's just been amazing to watch you grow. So I am so happy to have you on, Michael. I just want you to share the number one thing that I really want you to share with everybody, because your story, I think, can relate to a lot of people. So let's talk about, give me a little bit of background on really what your background was, what your life was before real estate, what brought you to real estate, and to where you are today.
Yeah, so thanks for having me again, Danielle. And how far back do you want to go?
Well, let's talk about you went to school. Like everybody, they go to school, you know, they follow that path and like, I'm going to do this. And then you get into that. I don't know. I think people, these kids, I mean, I have teenagers and they have to pick what they're going to do for the rest of their lives at the age of 16, 17. That's tough. By the time you graduate at 23, 24, 25, and you get into it, then you're like, well, wait a minute. This isn't what I thought, what I expected. And you've done some growth and that was ultimately kind of your story as well, right? So let's talk about that process.
Sure. So it goes back to that saying from Tony Robbins that life doesn't happen to you, it happens for you, right? And looking back now, I can kind of see all of the chips nicely falling into place. Even from my childhood, I'm left-handed, so I don't know if that means anything as far as creativity, but that's what they say. So I was always creative, had a wild imagination, building things out of Legos. I remember growing up as a kid, 4 or 5 years old, I had that big bucket of Legos. And I just would be building different things on top of the stone hearth of our fireplace. And, you know, watching shows like Art Attack and Mr. Dress Up and building things out of like taking all the soap boxes, the empty soap boxes.
But hang on a second. You're not old enough for Mr. Dress Up. That was my stage.
Well, he was around for a long time. And growing up with two older brothers, right? I got exposed to a lot of stuff from the 80s too. So watching that and Art Attack and just having this imagination, I was always putting things together. My dad was very handy. He's a mechanic. He's retired now, but he was a mechanic for 35 years. And he finished two of our basements. So I was always around kind of like building and fixing and things like that. So I kind of took a shine to that. Through a series of circumstances, my parents ended up moving when I was just finishing elementary school to Oakville from Mississauga. And by happenstance, this is where it gets interesting. The high school that I went to had an architectural elective. So instead of taking like a shop or a home ec, they had that. And since I was so artistic, I thought, that'd be pretty interesting to get into. And that's sort of how I got my foot in the door and exposed a little bit to architecture and drafting. And then from there, it turned into going to Sheridan College, taking their architectural technology program. And I actually, you know, a lot of people show their wins, but the first time I went, I was too immature and ended up flunking out of it.
Oh, wow. I didn't actually know that story. That's interesting.
Yeah, not too many people know that, right? I was just too immature. I knew what I wanted to do, fortunately, unlike a lot of teenagers, right? Because I was creative. I had that interest of both the combining of the design and the interest in building. And that was the link for architecture for me. So I ended up flunking out the first time. I went back to work with my brother, who does interlock and landscaping, so really hard labor. And one day I hurt my back. This was after I flunked out of college the first time. I hurt my back. I sprained my spine and I strained muscles along my spine. And that was the last day I said, no more of this. I can't be doing hard labor anymore, right? It's too taxing on the body. I should be using my mind to, you know, generate income. So I ended up going back to college shortly after, the very next semester that I could get in to start the program. And it was a 3-year program with co-op. I didn't end up doing the co-op, but I turned what would have taken 3.5 years into doing it in 2 years and 4 months. So I did 7 straight semesters consecutively without a break in between to catch up for lost time. So it was very taxing on the mind. I definitely was burnt out by the end of it, but I got the job done. And through making connections with one of the professors, and actually coincidentally with one of my brother's clients, who was the HR manager for an architectural firm downtown, a large one that my professor knew, he gave me a letter of recommendation to get in. Because, you know, I'd applied for different jobs growing up in high school, make some cash, buy my first car when I was 16 and everything like that. And the funny thing with employers for entry-level positions is they say they're entry-level positions, but they always want to hire someone that has experience, which just doesn't make any sense to me, right?
Yeah.
So I was very fortunate that that professor saw something in me and wrote the letter of recommendation, and I was able to get my foot in the door. I still had to, you know, go through the interview process and stuff like that, but it just shows that your network is very powerful in being able to get ahead in life. So from there, I ended up working with them on several projects, primarily in New York because it's a global firm. So I worked on some pretty large stuff. The Museum of Modern Art tower build, World Trade Center Tower number 3, the new World Trade Center, and a little bit on something called American Dreamland, which is like the supersized Edmonton Ball in New Jersey, I believe it was. I don't know if they actually proceeded with that project, but it gave me some pretty good exposure to kind of construction, real world construction, real world application, and commercial. But I realized after about 18 months that I didn't like sitting behind the computer every single day redoing doing drafting, right? I just found it to be very boring, especially with my interest in construction and understanding how things are built. That was one of the benefits of going to college versus university, where university is more theory, college is more technical and application. So I got exposed to building systems and construction methods and was interested in that. And again, just kind of things happening for you. Part of that program was project management. So I got a couple of different semesters worth of project management classes. And so I was like, I'm not really finding this interesting. I think I need to make a change. And that's how I transitioned into project management. But I had to take almost a step backward in order to get my foot in the door somewhere else. So I found a company that did commercial strip malls and gas stations on Kijiji. And I actually took less money by several thousand dollars to go and work with them to get some experience to then leapfrog to a much more established company which is the one I worked at for 6 years, and worked my way up the ranks from project coordinator to project manager on multi-million dollar jobs. But it just shows you kind of like how everything sort of happens for a reason. And then yeah. I'm very thankful for that experience that I got there, and the jobs I was exposed to, the stressors as well, because it's made me a more effective project manager, and it's made me a better communicator, specifically with tradespeople. And I've used all those skills that I compiled from architecture and from construction project management to then start my own business. First was architectural design firm, and now that's expanded into construction management firm that services investors in designing and building additional dwelling units. And that's kind of like the very condensed version of where I am today.
I love that. And you're right. Like, you know, like what you said, what Tony Robbins says, things don't happen to you, they happen for you. And I live by the mantra that things happen for a reason. And I think when things happen that is pretty crappy, we have one of two choices. We can choose to live in that negative space and victimize ourselves and say, I can't believe this happened to me. Nothing goes right. This is not what I planned. This is not how it's supposed to go. This is not what I envisioned. And you can have all of that negative self-talk. Or you can say, wow, I'm so glad that this happened to me, because now I know that this is not the path that I want to be on. Now I know that this is not the direction I want to be going in. And that empowers you to pivot and make a shift, which is what you've done all along and along the way. Now, you and I, when you were working for me, we used to go and look at a lot of projects that we had going on that were out of town, and we went on those long drives that you hated, and we would go and walk these properties. You still hate them. Come on.
I'm driving down to Florida with my wife, so.
I was pretty good company along the way, you got to admit.
You did. Like, yes, you were.
Yeah. We had such good conversations, and that's what I wanted to bring up on those rides. We had a lot of conversations about, you know, mindset and having the right mindset and looking at things from a perspective, a healthy perspective that's going to help you on your journey. And so many talks that we had, and I think that was part of your growth journey too, just, you know, having some good people around you to mentor you and help foster that. I think, you know, like you said, your network is your net worth, right? And so having that healthy mindset. And so you had that already going into, you know, corporate when you were doing all of that. But I would love for you to share. I know you shared it with me intimately, and maybe I'm stepping over the line here, but you shared with me kind of how that corporate space and the mindset in corporate really was unhealthy for you. Would you mind, or would you be willing to share and elaborate on that a little bit? Because I think a lot of people in the audience can relate.
Yeah, definitely. So I kind of skipped over that part.
That's the part that I want. That's the part that I want to hear.
It's very important. And I actually talk about that in one of my books, Where You Have Your Secrets, in the introduction, chapter one. But to give the audience kind of the backstory on that. So I started at that corporate job, the bigger company, in June of 2015. When I quit, it was June of 2021. So in the midst of COVID. What I found is, in the beginning, I was very driven, right? I was always driven to get to this certain point of status, which was the title of project manager and the six-figure salary that went with it. And just through that process of learning and growing and that drive to succeed, that was my laser focus, was getting to that level, right? And once I got to that level, I didn't like what I found. Not just with the amount of work that was required and the responsibilities of being in a position like that, managing projects that are worth tens of millions of dollars and tight timelines and very high-end type of clientele. It was also the corporate environment that I was kind of looking around and seeing the turnover of other staff that had gotten to the position of project manager, you know, leaving to other companies for money, but also the politics of corporate. So I read a book called The Motive. I can't remember who the author of it was, but if it comes to me, a very good book, I definitely recommend it. And what it kind of sums up exactly what I was seeing in the corporate environment, which is that there's two types of leaders. There's reward-based leaders, which is kind of like your managerial class now, and there's selfless leaders, the ones that lead by example, or he refers to it in the book, the author, as chief executing officers. right? So they're helping people learn, grow, expand, reach a new level. And by them reaching a new level, it's propelling the business to higher levels. And I feel like the politics of working in corporate was limiting my potential. I reached that ceiling and I wasn't able to break through it. And even asking my superiors, like, what do I have to do to reach that next level? And they couldn't give me an answer. Just keep doing what you're doing was the answer. I was like, what can I do? What courses can I take? What certificates can I get? Like, how do I get there? And they couldn't paint that picture for me. And then my drive just went right down the toilet, which I feel like probably happens to a lot of people that are working in that corporate environment. And I was just working.
But I feel like also, Michael, like part of it is not only do they not have the answer, they don't encourage that growth. Like there's no growth mindset in the, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I've not worked in the corporate space. I've always been in the small business space, but it just seems to me that they kind of put a damper on the growth mindset and you're just there to do a job, do it, don't ask questions. And that's it. Like, and it's just
falls
a
back
negative.
To the leadership, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So I mean, there's large corporate companies like Starbucks. And I mean, they have a very positive environment. I love going to Starbucks, not for the coffee, for the people, the experience. Mm-hmm. I go to the window. They're like, hi, Danielle, how's your day? Like, as we're waiting for my coffee to be brewed, like if I go through any other drive-through and I have to sit and wait, I'm irritated.
Well, they're like throwing it at you whenever you order it.
They're like, you know, here you go. And they, you know, if I ask for the receipt, they roll their eyes. Listen, I'm a business owner. I want the receipt. They roll their eyes because now it's going to take time for them to print the receipt. And it's like, I'm putting them out. But you go to Starbucks. And yeah, and if I have to wait at Tim Hortons, I get annoyed because I'm just sitting there waiting. And it's like, go to Starbucks. I always have to wait for my coffee because it's Starbucks. But they're like, yeah, how's your day going? And they just like, they call me by my name and they have chatter with me and they're just nice and happy people. So I don't want to say all corporate is like that, but a lot of corporate is just a very negative mind space. People are not happy. There seems the politics. I mean, that's where people are always like, you know, watching out for the next guy that's trying to, you know, stab them in the back. And that it just doesn't seem to me a healthy space. And you weren't in a healthy space mentally when you came to me. That was the beginning of your healing journey, I feel.
Yeah, definitely. So there came a point in 2019, after I got my title and six-figure salary that went with it, where I remember at my old house with Kayla, my head on her lap, and I was just like crying because I was saying that I don't feel like I'm the person that I'm supposed to be to her. And that was like when the cracks in the foundation started to form in late 2019, because I was putting in all this work and I wasn't getting what I expected out of it. And coming into 2019 and then with COVID happening and all the uncertainty with that and the lockdowns, we were still working because construction was still active until a certain point. I think it was at the start of May of 2020 where they then started shutting it down except for critical infrastructure, hospitals, like that kind of thing.
Yeah, it was the last
and
week
I was looking
of March.
Around.
Ask me how I know.
But
I had my project shut down.
Did you? Yeah, so we were still going until I think the start of May. And then they shut us down.
Yeah.
And I was looking around and I was seeing these people off and they're spending time with family and this and that. And even though we were done on the construction sites, we were still working remotely and stuff like that. And I just like, is this the kind of life that, you know, I want? And when the lockdowns kind of, we were in between lockdowns and I was back working at the office, this is in late 2020, December. And I was spending another night in the office by myself working on, because when you're a project manager, you're working all day to put out the fires. And then you can finally sit down and work on the actual paperwork side of it when everyone else is done, when the job sites are done and wrapped up. And I was sitting there by myself in the office. And I just like broke down. That was my breaking point. So I was sitting at the computer, palms like this, my head in my palms. I was like, came to the realization, that decision, right? That it takes so long to reach that point, but a decision happens in an instant. And just like that, I said to myself, well, if I don't see myself, like if I can't see a future for myself here doing this for the next 35 years, because I was 30 at the time, that would take me to retirement. And don't I see myself doing this in the next 5 years, the next 1 year, the next month, the next week, like why am I still here? Why don't I change? Right? Why don't I do something else? And that's where the decision was made that, like, I got to get out of here. I got to do something else. I got to make a change. I didn't really know what that change was going to be. I didn't know I would, you know, end up going back into what I was, you know, had become an expert in. But that was the point that I said, you know, I don't want to work for anyone else again. And I didn't end up leaving until 6 months later, because in March of 2020, or sorry, June of 2020, I'm misremembering now, we put a down payment on a new build house, and we didn't close until May of 2021. So I had to keep that job to have the income to qualify for the mortgage. And finally, I was able to, you know, give my 2 weeks notice, leave, and then it was a matter of figuring out, okay, what's next? And that's probably what advice I would give to anyone who's thinking about doing that. I was fortunate enough that I had a nest egg from selling the condo that I had in Oakville, which had doubled in value since I bought it in 2016. So I had that equity as a nest egg to sit on while I figured out what my next moves were. But I wasn't in a healthy space, like you said, mindset-wise, to try to figure that out at that time. I just needed to pull the parachute and do like an emergency exit, right? And so I spent the next 6 months after quitting figuring out what I was going to do. And then that's, you know, start of 2022 is when, again, by happenstance, a mutual connection that we had here in Kitchener introduced me to the morning group. And from the morning group, I went to an in-person event, and that's where we crossed paths. And then the rest is history.
Yeah. And then I snatched you up. But you were too motivated for me to hang on to you. But you know, but the thing is, again, coming back to the whole thing, everything happens for a reason. I mean, you ended up working with me and you thought, okay, you know what, I'm going to do this. I'm going to do project management. It's what I do well. If I do it on a smaller level instead of corporate, I have more organization. I don't have all these big bosses to report to and all these big clients to report to. But you really just found out that it's just not what you wanted to do, especially for somebody else. You really just had a taste of running your own business, and that's what you had in your mind. I'm always supportive, as you know, of people to do their own thing, and I don't ever want to hold anybody back. So totally supported your exiting. It was painful and sad for me because I enjoyed you while I had you, for sure. But yeah, I mean, you know, it's just been really a pleasure to watch you grow on your journey as you've been growing and finding your way. So, you know, you went into starting to work on building your architectural business, and then also realized, like, again, going back to years and years ago where you just didn't want to be in front of the computer drawing designs all day long. You wanted to interact with people and actually build those Legos like you seen when you were a kid. And so, so you ended up partnering also with somebody from the Morning Mat. So just for the audience, Michael referred to a Morning Mastermind group. That was a group that I had put together during COVID. 6 a.m. calls, 6:15 a.m. calls, where we were just jumping on, and Michael was one of the diehards that was there every morning. And then that's how we met. But your business partner, you also met in that mastermind group as well, right?
I actually met him before that.
Oh, you did?
He's the one that connected me to the morning group. Yeah.
Gotcha. Okay. Gotcha. Yeah. See the connection. Yep. But your network is everything, right? I mean, that's where it all happens. And so now you have a construction business and you're doing ADU. So let's talk about, like, that's the history. And I think it's really important to share that so that people realize, like, the journey. Because, again, in the spirit of the podcast, I like it's Let's Get Real Estate Podcast. I want to get real with people, because there's a lot of people that want to get into real estate and they go, well, I don't have the money. I don't have the skills. I don't have the this or that. And well, I'm just an engineer. Or I'm just an architect. But look at you killing it in real estate right now. And as a business owner, oh, I don't have an MBA. I can't be a business owner. Here you are as a business owner. And so the spirit of this podcast was always to empower people that you can do it too, no matter what. You just need to go out there and, you know, take a chance, educate yourself, and then start making a move in that direction. And so, but you're doing big things now. You wrote the two books. By the way, stay on the call because we got something very special, special, special for you that Michael is going to offer everyone for free. So you want to hang tight till the end. But the one of the books is Rehabbing Your Way to Wealth. And rehabbing is essentially just taking a property and putting a little bit of money into it, lifting it up for a better tenant quality, upping the value of your property. And it's a really great strategy for people in real estate, especially if you want to start growing your wealth fast, because you can up the equity of your real estate and then turn it over into something else, into another project. So I just wanted to say, now, moving forward with what you're doing, tell me more about ADUs, because this is the buzz. This is what people are talking about. This is what people are really wanting to know more. And especially now with existing real estate investors, I'm encouraging our students, when we look at their portfolio, instead of trying to make something work in the market that we're in right now in the economic environment, maybe the numbers don't work. Well, look at maximizing your current portfolio, and you can add density, which is to say add an extra unit. And that is what you're specializing in now with your companies and what you're doing. So let's talk a little bit more about that. So do you want to share with the audience what ADU stands for, what that means, what different ADUs look like, because there's a lot of interchangeable names too, like Garden Suite, Laneway Homes, all of that. So if you want to just help educate the audience a little bit about what this is and what the benefits are of building ADUs.
Sure. Yeah. So ADU stands for additional dwelling units. And in the eyes of the building code, a dwelling unit is a separate self-contained unit. So I'm sure a lot of investors are familiar with duplexing, which in most situations you have, say, a bungalow or 1.5-story or 2-story, and the upper level is one unit, and then you convert the basement into a legal basement apartment, and then there you go, you have a duplex. So you have two separate self-contained units independent of one another. There are very different ways that you can do that. One that's kind of all a buzz right now is adding garden suites, which go by many different names, like you said, laneway houses, granny flats, tiny homes, backyard homes. Like, I don't think any one municipality has said this is the name that we're calling it. But
that's why people are confused.
That's right. Yeah. So that's one option, right? Another option is you can also build up or build out of the existing home. So adding on an addition, either as another story or as a side yard if you have the space, or a rear yard addition, and add another dwelling unit that way. And the purpose of it is by adding more units onto one single family lot, you're therefore having more income generated from it. In order to carry the lot, you're building up equity in it. Rather than finding the capital to purchase another property, you're maximizing the one that you already have.
Yeah, I love that. And so what are the benefits of doing that though? Why would somebody consider doing that instead of taking the capital that they have to put into building these projects and buying something new?
We're just increasing the cash flow for that one property that you already own, right? And you're saving yourself the headache of going through that somewhere else.
Absolutely. And it also increases the value of your property as well. So it's actually increasing the net worth of your portfolio, exactly. Right?
Yeah. Now you still have to run the numbers and make that decision for yourself. Does it make sense to pour the capital into the property that I already have and maximize it that way? One property is just less work as far as if you're doing property management for it, right? Then multiple properties, depending on where you're buying, are those properties spread out at different cities, or are you investing in just one locale? So there's certainly advantages to it. But at the end of the day, it comes back to what do the numbers tell you? And then that's how you base your decision.
Yeah. I mean, so let's say somebody out there has three rental units, they have three bungalows, you know, entry level homes that they bought as secondary properties, they want to rent it out. And now the bank isn't really financing them for anything else because, you know, their debt service is so high. So here's a great strategy where you can maybe potentially borrow private money to get the costs for the renovations or for the build. And you can add, if you have a bungalow, you could potentially put a unit in the basement, and then you put an ADU outside in the yard or a laneway home if you have laneway access, which, by the way, it's the same thing. It's just a different word. And now you've went from one unit on that property to three. Now you have three doors on that property. And if you have three units, you can go from three rental income to 9 rental income if you can do that on all 3 properties that you own. And so if you're going out there in the market and you're trying to find something that doesn't work and the numbers don't work and the banks won't finance you, here's a way to potentially make this work. Because now what's happened is you're going out there and refinancing to pay off the private debt. Now you have that extra 2 income on that one property. It's going to cash flow well. It's going to work to your favor. So I'm just saying, like, this is an opportunity right now with the economy kind of not favorable for people getting loans, the banks tightening up. It's something that we can do as investors to help with continuing to build our portfolio and build our net worth without really feeling handcuffed, right?
Mm-hmm, exactly. And I would say with the royal assent of Bill 103 allowing 4 units as of right, it even makes it that much more appealing.
Absolutely.
For investors to build on a lot. Because if you can build 4 instead of 3 and you're generating, you know, let's just say hypothetically, say you're generating $8,000 to $10,000 of cash flow, right? Of income from that property, minus, you have to minus expenses, obviously. But now you're even to able to maximize and take that one property further.
Absolutely.
And Danielle, they haven't finalized a lot of cities what that's going to look like, whether it's going to be the main house can turn into a triplex and then you can have a single unit through garden suite or laneway suite in the backyard, or if you can do a 2-and-2 type of situation where you have 2 duplexes. But that will also help as far as when you're able to add that 4th unit, you're already doing the construction for that 3rd unit anyways. Now you're able to add 4. So it makes it even that much more attractive. Just the hard part is that the banks, because it's so new, or they haven't figured out what they're going to reappraise it at, what the value is. There are some that that's like the number one question from our clients is who are investors. That's who we serve. We serve investors primarily is what is the ARV after I put in, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of funds, whether it's cash or private money. What's the end result going to be? What do the numbers look like? And it's still so new. It's very hard for me to give that feedback. I mean, you have to go and talk to your mortgage broker because I can design and build it for you. But I can't tell you what it's going to, there's just not enough data. Still so new.
It is very new, but it's really starting to pick up traction. And I think, you know, if people Absolutely. Are considering putting in ADUs now, you know, by the time it's built, you're looking at 6 months, maybe 8 months, depending on when you start the build and winter and that sort of thing. I think we're going to have more and more of these showing up on the market and so that we can get the comps. And the issue that Michael is referring to is there's not a whole lot of comparables on the market because people are doing these, they're adding them and they're not selling. I mean, they want to refinance and keep them. And so since you're not selling these units, there's not a whole lot of market comps. I remember going through this when I was flipping and I started doing conversions and adding basement units and nobody, like I was flipping. And so we were looking at the numbers, like what is it worth? And I had the same issue because the conversion projects that I did, I hung on to, but we couldn't evaluate them because all of us that were doing, there's only a few of us at the time, we had these conversion units, but we weren't selling them. And so there really wasn't market comps on the market. And so we knew on the market, it would sell for a lot more because you could have that extra income on that property. But properties that we were comparing it to was like having, you know, an in-law suite in the basement, but it wasn't legal. And that legal component actually bumps up that number quite a bit. The ARV that Michael is talking about is the after repair value. So after renovation value, what is it going to look like on the market? But when you're renovating, you just have to be, and you're going to keep it, you have to be conservative on that final valuation when you're running your numbers. Yeah. So having said that though, let's talk about the top things that, people need to consider when they're doing renovations or doing additions on their existing property. So what are the things? I mean, parking is one of them, obviously. Square footage. So the area, right? So what should people know about when they're considering adding an ADU?
Yeah, so I would definitely recommend if you are planning one to find someone, a company, an expert like myself to help you through that process. Or if you're adamant on self-managing that process, to go and contact your municipality's planning department to find out what the zoning bylaw requirements are for building either an addition or something like a garden suite. and they'll go through, and it's going to be very similar amongst municipalities, but they don't have to be necessarily exactly the same. So one municipality might require this setback or that setback from one of the property lines, for example, in order to build. So like you said, parking is one, the actual unit size, how much lot coverage can you get on it? So for example, garden suites and kitchener have to be 50% of the primary dwelling unit's square footage. So if it's 1,000 square feet, then the max you can build is 500 square feet for a garden suite. That's why I always recommend to investors, if we can look at the option, especially if it's a vacant property, to do an addition, that might be more valuable because you probably build a larger unit, but it just depends. Depends what they're looking for. Right. So definitely building size, setbacks from the side yard property lines and the rear yard property line, and also the existing dwelling unit or the existing house, that's all factored in. And that's primarily for fire separation. Parking is definitely a big one, and that can be a challenge depending on the size of the lot, how much you have to work with, and depending on what the city has mandated in the zoning bylaw. For example, in Kitchener, you can do 3 cars tandem, which makes it a little bit easier. Not ideal by any circumstances, even for a duplex, to have 2 tenants for 2 different units. Parking in tandem is a pain in the butt.
But, can you explain to the audience what tandem means?
Yeah, so basically it's just 1 car parked behind the other. So in that scenario, you'd have 3 different cars from 3 different units all parked one behind the other. So this tenant, if it's a single length width driveway, you know, the upstairs tenant would have to go and knock on the door of the garden suite tenant in the backyard and say, hey, can you move your car? Or, you know, one situation like that, which you don't want. So it's not ideal. And that's not
as a landlord, you don't want that, because what happens is then you got fights happening between tenants, and then you have to like arbitrate those. So it is a pain. However, if you can meet the city standards, and then you have the 2 parking, but then you just offer maybe the back unit or the smaller unit with no parking, then you don't have that issue.
So in most circumstances, you're going to need 1 parking space dedicated per lot. That doesn't mean you need to divvy it up that way on your lease contract, but...
Well, that's what I'm saying. So like, if I have a property that has tandem parking for 2 units, I offer no parking to 1 unit. And they have to figure that out. And because I'm not going to deal with them having, if it's tandem, side by side works brilliantly. But if it's tandem, one of the ways to avoid having to, because as a property owner, you don't want to have increased problems and increase the management time that you're going to be putting into that property. So ultimately, especially like, I mean, it happens. People will fight for less than a parking spot. So like, you know, you just don't want tenants duking it out over, you know, and have a domestic dispute where cops are called and stuff. Stuff like that happens, guys. So if you can avoid that by just saying, you know what, this unit is, you know, the rear unit's a 1+1 and there's no parking available, then you just don't have that problem anymore. But you do have to meet the city compliance standards, which is you need 2 spots. And so if it's tandem, then you meet the spots and that's okay. It's not ideal, but it's okay.
Yeah, you definitely have to check your specific city's requirements. I'm just using that as an example from Kitchener. It's going to be very interesting when they allow 4 units and update the zoning bylaw for that, what they're going to do for the parking requirements. I know in certain cases, the closer you are to the downtown core, where there's more public transit options available for you, even in Kitchener, and I'm sure it's in other cities as well, probably in Hamilton, that you don't have to provide the same number of parking spaces because of that public transportation. It's always something to look into. And if you don't have an existing property, you're looking at buying a property, you definitely want to make sure that all those boxes are ticked before you pull the trigger on something. Yes. The other thing, zoning bylaw related, is the lot width. So in Kitchener, the minimum lot width is 43 feet. Now, in certain cases, you can go down the minor variance path, but that's just more time, more money, and you have to decide if that's worth it or not. So I think those are probably all the big boxes that need to be ticked.
Yeah. And I just want to reiterate exactly what you just said is like, you want to make sure that you do your due diligence. If you buy a property and you go, oh, it looks like it's a big lot, I'll be able to add an ADU. It's really not that black and white. You need to understand what you need to comply with, what standards you have to meet in order to be able to get the application approved from the city. So these are some of the bigger ones that Michael mentioned. Write them down. And I just want to circle back, Michael, to what you said about finding a professional that does this. So if I didn't know anything about ADUs and I was out there looking, because there's a lot, and I'm going to give you guys all a heads up, a lot of designers out there, because when you want to do an ADU, you have to draw out the design, you have to put it together. Not everybody is equipped, even though they're a licensed professional, a licensed architect, designer, engineer, that doesn't mean that they know all of the little ins and outs and the quirks with the bylaws and the mandates that the city has asked for. So you want to get somebody who's an investor-friendly architect, designer, who knows what the city is looking for, who specializes in ADUs. But how, if I don't know anything about it, how do I find that guy, Michael?
You just have to ask for them experience. How many projects have they done? What do they have in their portfolio to show you? Like for us, last year alone, I submitted and had approved 5 different garden suite permits. So the first one didn't go smoothly, but then the second, right? It's just a learning curve. What does the city ask for? Even the city is figuring out what the requirements are, you know, on the fly, right? So part of it's my inexperience on that. And part of it is the city trying to figure out what the process is. And they're constantly updating, making changes to the bylaw without putting, informing people. But then the second one was a little bit smoother. And the one after that was even smoother. And the last one that we did, which we got approved for in early November, took 2 or 3 weeks.
Nice. Like
the first one took 4 or 5 months. And the second one, the last one took 2 weeks. So it's just that learning curve through experience, right? And you know what the city's looking for each time, so you can improve your the information that you're putting on the drawings, or knowing exactly what they're looking for, the plans examiner, when they're reviewing it. Not just on the architectural side, but structural, HVAC as well. That's a big important one that you need HVAC consultant to design your heating and cooling systems. In the beginning, the first one I submitted, I tried to do it without it, because the year prior, my business partner had submitted with a different designer for a garden suite and didn't have to provide it. So as the, I mean, just like it's this constant.
Yeah. As the city evolves, they're evolving too, because it's just such a new process, right? It's a new strategy, and so the cities are evolving, the designers, the professionals are evolving, and of course the builders need to evolve with that as well. So because, you know, things are looking a little bit different on these drawings than they would on a traditional build, right? And so there's definitely some patience and a huge learning curve too, but making sure that your designer has done this before and is in this space is a big plus. And the one thing that I love about you, Michael, is that you're not just designing, but you're also building it. And so you're on the ground, you're watching it go up, you're managing the construction on the back end after the approvals, which is a one-stop shop, which most designers, they say, here you go. And then you got to go find your contractors. And now you got to go through the same process of finding a contractor or builder who understands this process and what the city is looking for, and dealing with the inspectors, the city inspectors that are also just learning as they go as well. So
yeah, and all of them are different.
There's a lot of
gray area from inspector to inspector.
100%.
Especially depending on how long they've been in doing it for, right? But you're right. It's like you can go and you can hire a designer and you can pay, I'll just throw out a number, say $1,500 or $2,000 for a set of drawings. And yes, they're a designer, but that doesn't mean that they're qualified to give you the best possible end product, whether that is to transfer and pass the drawings over to a contractor and for them to pick up the blueprints and know what exactly it is that they need to price, because there could be a lot of scope gaps is a project management term, but that just means that the information that you need that contractor to price and do an accurate bid off of is missing from the drawings. So if they don't know, or they're purposefully leaving out of their bid to then later charge for change orders, like that's one route. But if you're working with a designer who is putting all that information into the drawings or communicating to you what's required, even if you don't end up working with us, let's say, but as an investor, you can take that to a contractor and say, here's the blueprints, here's all the details, here's the approved permit, how much is it going to cost me, how long is it going to take me, and you know, I'm ready to go.
Yeah, and so if they forget it on the scope, then that's on them, because it was actually on the drawings. And that's happened to me before, both ways, where I've had drawings where something that needed to get done wasn't included on the drawings, but by building code, we needed that. And when I go to the architect and they're like, oh, well, that's just that, obviously that needs to be done. Everybody knows that's like standard, But then when I talked to the contractor, he's like, well, it wasn't on the drawing, so I didn't quote for it. I thought you didn't want it. And so now, knowing that he has to build it per the Ontario Building Code, the OBC, but like you said, maybe purposefully not putting it on the scope so that his number can be a little bit lower. And I've had it flip the other side too, where, you know, there's a lot on the drawings and then the builder, the contractor missed something and they had a lower price, but they bid for everything that was on the drawing. And I'm like, well, if you missed it, that's not on me, that's on you. Because it was written there and you quoted your job based on these drawings. So it can definitely happen and it goes both ways. But yeah, there's a lot of moving parts, guys. But you know what? These ADUs are a great resource. So is Michael, and he is very active on social media and he is passionate about helping people. That's why he wrote these two books. He wants to help people in my audience, people out there in general, to learn and to grow the way he is. And so if you guys want to reach out to him, I highly recommend you connect with him on Instagram, which is the best way to reach out for him. And I did promise something free that Michael was going to offer for free. So if you want to share, Michael, what that is and let everybody know, drum roll.
Yeah. So for your guests, Danielle, if they go and follow me, and you probably have this in the show notes, but my Instagram handle is at Michael Emmanuel Official. Reach out to me, send me a direct message. Let me know that you watched Danielle's show. And while you're at it, make sure you give it a 5-star review. I'll give them you're welcome. I'll give them a digital copy of my book, Rehabbing Your Way to Wealth, which covers the top 10 property rehabbing mistakes that real estate investors make and how to avoid them. So it's not, you don't know what you don't know. And if like I've spent over 10 years in architecture and construction, and there's still a lot that I don't know. So I would say I've mastered this, but I'm still a student, right? And these books, that one in particular, by understanding what not to do and opening your eyes up to that, it doesn't just tell you that, it also provides solutions, whether you haven't made that mistake yet, how to avoid it, or if you're in the middle of it, how to get out of it. So I think that's important for every investor to understand. I want to give that, put that in the hands of as many investors as I can. I'm not trying to become a millionaire off of these two books, but I'm trying to share and provide value to real estate investors, because that's my background. That's what I'm passionate about. And that's not, you know, what every real estate investor is in. They're not like you, Danielle, who learned a bunch themselves through trial and error, right? Over so many years flipping projects and then transitioning into rehabbing properties and buying holds, right? So I want to give that information to them and shorten that learning gap.
Yeah, man. Like if I could have had a book like that to help me avoid some mistakes by learning by other people's mistakes. Yeah. I mean, this is golden material, guys. So make sure you go to Michael's Instagram. It's Michael Emmanuel Official. Find his Instagram, follow him, shoot him a DM that you'd like the book, that you saw him on my podcast, either whether it's on YouTube or on your podcast platform that you prefer, and he'll send that book to you. That's amazing. Further to that, if you have any questions, you want to connect with Emmanuel, how you can work, or I keep saying that, connect with Michael and how to work with him and you know, potentially hire him or work with him or collaborate in some capacity, you can shoot him a DM for that too. All that information is going to be in the show notes. So make sure, and thank you, by the way, Michael, for sharing, you know, that little reminder. Make sure you give me a review, guys. So if you're liking what you're hearing, you can go to your podcast, your platform that you enjoy the most. Make sure you click subscribe so you don't miss any more upcoming episodes, as well as if it's on YouTube, you can click subscribe to the channel there and you'll see everything that pops up. So guys, I just want to say thanks for always being loyal, coming back to the show and listening. And Michael, thank you for taking the time to share some great nuggets on this newest thing, this newest strategy in investing in real estate. And that's with these ADUs.
You're welcome, Danielle. Thanks again for having me.
And with that, guys, this is Danielle Chason signing off of the Let's Get Real Estate podcast, where I bring to you real people doing real estate. Bye for now.
Thanks so much for listening to our podcast, and congratulations on improving your education real estate.
Please leave a review only if you felt we provided value, as it would really help us if you would leave a 5-star review so that we can help reach a broader audience.
And don't forget to comment what you enjoyed and tell us what you are looking to learn more about.
As always, thanks for your support, and we'll see you on the next episode.